difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Genevieve Kosky
and Tasha Robinson.
Matt Singer is also back, of course, after a busy and productive week. Hello again, Matt.
Hello. And once again, Keith, not here, ducking me.
Yeah. Wow, this is turning into a real rivalry. There's something something here. Some unfinished business.
That's exactly what I'm saying. There is something here.
If that something happens to be a severed hand that looks like Keith's that's crawling around and attacking you, we had nothing to do with that. I just want that on the record.
So on last week's episode, we talked about Army of Darkness, the final film in Sam Raimi's Evil Dead trilogy, and the first to get the backing of a major studio. Raimi has been working within the studio system for three decades since, with original projects like The Quick and the Dead and Drag Me to Hell, alongside blockbuster tentpoles like his Spider-Man trilogy with Tobey Maguire. But now, Raimi boards the MCU mothership with Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, the 28th film of the franchise and among its most eventful and stylistically distinctive. Benedict Cumberbatch returns as Doctor Strange, who has cast a spell that has cracked open the multiverse, spilling all sorts of apocalyptic threats from one alternate reality to another. One such threat, a giant space octopus, takes a particular interest in a teenage girl, America Chavez, played by Xochitl Gomez. America's special power is that she has the ability to transport herself through the multiverse. She's basically the human version of the Spice in Dune, and she'll need to figure out how to harness that power to stop Wanda Maximoff, aka Scarlet Witch, the sorceress and sad mom played by Elizabeth Olsen. Characters from the first Doctor Strange return here too in various capacities, including Chiwetel Ejiofor as Carl Mordo, Benedict Wong as Wong, and Rachel McAdams as Christine Palmer. There's also a coveted text called The Darkhold, or The Book of the Damned. Sounds familiar. We'll talk about it after the break.
The nightmare begins. I did what I had to do to protect our world.
You cannot control everything, Strange. You opened the doorway between universes, and we don't know who or what will walk through it.
Wanda, what do you know about the multiverse?
Viz had his theories. He believed it was dangerous.
He was right. I'm sorry, Stephen. Your desecration of reality will not go unpunished.
All right, so Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, the 28th film of the MCU. Where are we at? First tier, second tier, third tier? What did you all think of this movie? Matt, again, you're our guest. Let's start with you.
I don't know I don't know about the tier I would put it in. I guess sort of the upper half, I suppose. I mean, I think it's generally pretty enjoyable as these things go. I mean, to me, the thing that I really enjoyed about it was, I mean, as we established on our previous episode, like, I'm a huge Sam Raimi fan. And a lot of this movie did feel like a Sam Raimi movie to me. And that was the stuff that I really enjoyed, was the moments where I could feel Sam Raimi sort of taking the reins and really kind of using this Marvel milieu to do the kind of stuff that he likes. And that's mostly in the second half. Certainly, you mentioned the Darkhold, this the Book of the Damned. You know, I sort of smiled when I went, oh, here's this a Sam Raimi movie about an evil book. And it's, you know, and then later on, you have Bruce Campbell showing up and his hands get possessed and start smacking himself in the face. And it's like, oh, this is, you know, we're in familiar territory here. There's a lot of stuff like that. And so I don't think I will be watching this movie as many times as I have seen Army of Darkness, for example. I don't think I will come back to it that often. It did not give me that much pleasure, but, you know, I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it certainly more than a lot of the other recent Marvel movies, which I've, even as I am a huge comic book dork, I have found some of the recent ones a little lacking, and I thought at least the Raimi-esque touches in this one at least put it over the top for me.
What about you, Genevieve?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm sort of similarly qualified in my enjoyment of it. I will note that the first Doctor Strange is probably like bottom tier Marvel for me. I know that is maybe different from some other people on this podcast, but I'll just put this out there. I never saw the first Doctor Strange in the theater. I attempted to watch it at home 3 times and fell asleep during like somewhere around like the beginning of the second act all 3 times. So I did finally knuckle down and watch it all in preparation for the second movie, which I will say at least I enjoyed more than the first Doctor Strange, although the extent to which that is attributable to like me seeing it like in the theater on big fake IMAX, like I can't say, but like a lot of Marvel movies, I enjoyed it a lot in the moment. Like these are kind of like theme park ride movies. I'm not the first person to make that comparison, but like in the moment, like, yeah, I was having a lot of fun. I came out of it, you know, feeling like, yeah, that was fun. But then like the longer I thought about it and like tried, like collected my thoughts and like what I might want to say about it, I was like, you know, like especially everything going on with Wanda and the storyline there, like the longer I thought about it, the less well it sat with me. And we can perhaps get into that, you know, in more depth later. But to pivot off what Matt was saying, like, I also like got the kind of the greatest moments of enjoyment, sort of like the loop-de-loops in the theme park ride, when I did see those like Raimi touches, you know, or like when I could recognize a specific vision poking out in there. The eyeball octopus monster at the beginning, you know, being sort of the obvious first jolt of that. Although like there's a little moment, right, I guess it's part of that scene, but like when Doctor Strange, he's at a wedding when this attack happens and has a, you know, sees what's happening, he's like, oh, I have to, you know, fly into action, and he downs his martini and then kind of just like falls over the ledge and into his cape, and now he's Doctor Strange. And it reminded me a lot kind of like the pizza moment in Spider-Man, like just sort of this like little like grace note of like funny normal human moment within a hero moment, you know. That was when I was like, oh, yeah, I see Sam Raimi here. And then that went away for large chunks of the movie. But, you know, again, I fell for so much in this, like in the moment, like all the little cameos that we can, I guess, get into, you know, another universe, we see all sorts of Marvel folk, you know, and I'm cynical about that in the broad sense, but like in the moment I was like, hee, 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 you know, so I don't know. Like this happens to me a lot with these movies. So this is what we're talking about maybe with the Turn Your Brain Off movie.
Tasha, how about you?
I mean, I think that really about sums it up. I enjoyed the experience of watching this movie. I enjoyed the experience of being in the theater. I was in New York on a work trip with my Polygon co-workers, meeting them for the first time in person. And we're a bunch of big nerds. And I was sitting next to our comics editor, Susanna Polo, who's the biggest nerd. And just like experiencing that movie next to somebody who like knows every character, every cameo, every clue, every hint, every Easter egg was fun. And experiencing it in a full theater full of people who were really, really invested, you know, who gasped at the gasp moments and cheered at the cheer moments. And like audibly, the air left the room at the mid-credit sequence when like a certain referential character shows up for the first time, having never been in these movies. That said, I have a ton of problems with this film, but they're all either kind of intellectual problems or just kind of problems of, to some degree, of character. Like, I think Stephen Strange is just kind of a version of Iron Man with a cloak. Like his thing, instead of being rich and having tech, is being powerful and having magic. But he's the exact same kind of, like, you know, arrogant, pompous, it's okay for me, but not for you kind of guy who breaks all the rules and gets away with it. And I feel like the best usage of him was when he and Tony Stark came up against each other and, like, immediately hated each other in the crossover movies, because they're so much of a type together. And, like, of course, the most arrogant ass in the room doesn't like meeting the other most arrogant ass in the room. But when he's front and center as the protagonist, it's problematic. You know, when we're expected to feel something, I guess, when he walks up to the woman that he just never quite had time or space or emotion for at her wedding, to very stiffly tell her that he's sorry that it came to this because he just didn't make time for her. Like, completely writing off her choice, her marriage, her love, and thinking only about himself and how none of this would have happened if, you know, he had just behaved differently. It's just a powerful failure of empathy that makes me roll my eyes. But so much of this movie does care about how he feels about Christine and how he feels a loss around Christine. And there's an interesting parallel there that's sort of necessary, because him feeling this loss and wanting things to play out differently parallels Wanda's feeling of loss and how she's willing to kill anybody who gets in her way for it. You know, he's quote unquote the good guy and wouldn't stoop to such things, but he certainly feels the urge. That's an interesting aspect of this movie that I wish it had the breath to explore a little more. And, you know, instead it's doing, like, fun, cheer-worthy stuff. Everything about the multiverse alternate Avengers, I think, is fun and exciting. And hey, it's that guy for, you know, us nerds. And it's just exciting to see a lot of this stuff. But I just don't think that Doctor Strange is a good movie protagonist. Mm-hmm. I don't think his emotions are interesting. I don't think his choices are interesting. And I think that what makes this movie a lot better than the first Doctor Strange is that there's so much going on that isn't him. There are so many characters that aren't him. This movie cares a little more about Christine as a person. It cares a lot about America as a person. It even cares about Wanda a little bit as a person. And the fact that it makes room for all of that stuff, and, like, Stephen Strange and his arrogance and his issues just kind of keep getting sort of pushed off to the side, I think is the right choice. I do enjoy the Raimi of it all. I enjoy the energy and the slapstick of this movie. I almost feel like if it wasn't just so Marvel, if it wasn't just so necessary for this to have the tone it has and deal with Stephen Strange the way it does, it probably would have been better to see him getting poked in the eyes by skeletons a few more times, because that dude deserves it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, though. It's like, now that you mentioned the arrogant part, I mean, not to immediately jump into connections here, but I think there's a certain amount of disappointment for me with the Doctor Strange character as he is in this movie, that he isn't more Bruce Campbell-like, that Raimi doesn't kind of get more comic mileage out of Doctor Strange, in his arrogance in this movie. I think it's much more pronounced in the first movie, which again, I think, like a lot, like everyone else, I would put on a sort of a lower tier.
For some reason, I thought you were a fan of the first Doctor
Strange.
It's
in the middle. It's just kind of
was it your huge Doctor Strange tattoo you have on your back?
It's also, you know, characters who could do magic and stuff. It's just like the whole thing where they're kind of straining and their lights are going protruding from their face. It's just like, no, that's never that compelling cinematically. And then you've got another character in Scarlet Witch who does that sort of thing too, and it's like, give me the hand-to-hand combat, you know, give me
is it that they don't take advantage of the arrogance of Doctor Strange, or is it that Benedict Cumberbatch maybe doesn't have the comedic chops of a Bruce Campbell?
Yeah, maybe
to
that's,
take
maybe
advantage
that's
of.
It too. Maybe there was nothing to seize an advantage on in terms of that. Because, I mean, to me, there's a lot of comedy that could be mined from that, but there wasn't. There was comedy to be mined in the first movie, and none of that happened. So
Well, in hearing Tasha talk about him in relation to Tony Stark, like, I think that really highlights the comedic charisma that Robert Downey Jr. brought Benedict Cumberbatch either is incapable or uninterested in bringing to Stephen Strange. And like, I feel in the first movie, it was maybe a little more understandable on a performance level because like that character is going through like a really traumatic experience, even though it doesn't really seem to have a whole lot of effect on him in that movie, but I digress. But here, like by this point, like he's a superhero, like it just like he should be leaning into the fun of it at this point in his tenure, I guess, as a MCU character. And it kind of feels like Benedict Cumberbatch maybe does not want to be doing this.
Though he has screwed up horribly, right? I mean, he's made a horrible error, like a massive error. Like he's made huge, bigger mistakes that should be sobering to him, right? Than the other superheroes in terms of like, didn't he just open up the whole multiverse and then didn't he do something involving the stone, I guess? Wasn't there something involving a stone? I'm trying well, here,
that,
guys. I'm
all
trying.
Of that was all Did that was Spider-Man's fault.
What are you
oh
talking
my God,
about, Scott?
Yeah, you guys just want to see him like straining for like 3 minutes to pass a stone, which then turns into a monster and attack him. I don't know where you're coming from here. I think that Marvel has its own history to maintain and has its archetypes to maintain here. And Doctor Strange's whole thing is kind of a stuffy, removed intellectual arrogance. Like his whole thing is he's the master of the mystic arts. He's not the master of hilarious slapstick. I don't think that this movie is missing much by not like giving him gags. And I also think Benedict Cumberbatch is funny. Like I think that the business that happens in Thor Ragnarok with between him and Thor, where he's throwing Loki around through portals and just like zapping them all over his sanctum and making beer appear in Thor's hands and just like treating him like a nincompoop, that whole sequence is hilarious. I go back and rewatch it occasionally. I want to put this way more in Marvel's hands and in Raimi's hands than in Benedict Cumberbatch's hands, because I don't think that there's any reason to believe that he's the one out there saying like, oh no, Doctor Strange, noted purveyor of clown-like japes and comedy, needs to be very huffy and serious in my hands because it's important.
I will say, in his defense, after I was the one who, you know, threw him under the bus to start all of this, like the end of the movie, you do sort of see that more outrageous side come through, you know, like when he's, I don't know, I guess we can just spoil this.
Oh yeah,
at this point.
Yeah.
That, you know, at the end of the movie, when he's playing a zombie version of himself and giving a pep talk to just saying, it makes me laugh. The idea of the sheer lunacy of this scene, like the big emotional moment of this movie is a zombie Doctor Strange sort of giving a pep talk to a teenager that, you know, like, you can do it kind of a thing. Like, he really kind of plays that part to the hilt. And I thought he was really sort of, he was going for it there. So, you know, maybe he does have it in him, but maybe it is just the deficiencies of the character, or just the limitations, I should say, of the character. Because as Tasha says, yeah, he's not exactly, you know, he's not the funniest Marvel superhero canonically. And I did find him more enjoyable to follow, as everyone else has said. Like the first movie is also not one of my, you know, that really is one of my less favorite Marvel movies. And a lot of it is sort of exactly what Tasha was saying, that he just really does feel like kind of like an Iron Man light in that movie with magic stuff. And in here, there is so much other, there's other characters, other storylines, there's all the fun with all the other cameos, that there is enough other stuff around him that him playing sort of the straight man kind of works, just because there's so much, there's a multiverse of madness, if you will, swirling around him throughout the movie.
It's a wonder. It's the best title of any Marvel movie for sure. I would give it that. I mean,
as somebody who's been trying to figure out how to manage headlines that have that entire title in them, I disagree. Sure, titles.
Yeah. Not no. SEO friendly.
It's the melancholy and the infinite sadness of Marvel movies. one of the things to me, because I'm very director focused, which of course makes Marvel just the enemy for me, even though I like most of their movies, is just I'm fascinated by the relationship between a director and a director's vision and the machine, and to me, those two things kind of run into conflict here in a way that's, it's kind of refreshing and exciting and also limiting too. I mean, because you do have these moments, which are my favorite moments of the movie, particularly in the second half, where it does kind of become a Sam Raimi movie, where a lot of that mythological baggage, where a lot of the template for what needs to happen to keep this machine running is sort of left behind, and Raimi is a little bit more freed up to do the kind of crazy stuff he likes to do with the zombie and the weird cape with all the ghosts on it or something. Like, this guy, it feels free, it feels liberated, it feels very much distinctively him, like the first time you could actually look at a Marvel film and identify it by the director. I don't think there's any other Marvel film that you could do that with, but I don't necessarily think that jives with, that doesn't necessarily help make a successful Marvel movie in a way, because you have this expectation set for how they're supposed to operate, and you can feel the different elements in this movie kind of in conflict with each other, and certain things just not connecting at all. I mean, we haven't talked really much about the Wanda Maximoff / Scarlet Witch part of that, but none of that worked for me at all. And I didn't feel like the film, on a filmmaking level, there was a whole lot of engagement in it. And it just seemed like, okay, this is something that has to be in the movie because this is what we're doing. We're having this. This is the reason why this movie is happening. And it felt like Raimi disappeared during all that stuff. And we just had to deal with it. And it was just, this is what it was. I don't know. What did you all think?
I want you to underline what exactly about it didn't work for you, Scott, because there are a lot of criticisms being weighed at, Wanda turning into a villain and Wanda's specific choices and Wanda's motivations. And there are arguments sort of for and against. But I think to have this conversation, we need to know, specifically what about it didn't work.
It just seems so trite. I mean, all this connections that she has with these children, as being this motivation that she has to completely destroy and upend everything, which I guess is part of WandaVision as well. It's so psychologically narrow. I did not feel like this was a particularly rich character motivation-wise, I would say.
Is it because you have any attachment to or feeling about who that character was or who she should be? Or you just think, as a villain, the fact that she wants her fake kids back is just thin?
To me, I mean, I guess it kind of echoes WandaVision, which I think is a pretty successful show. That felt to me like the world of that show is sort of a manifestation of the same types of feelings. And it works so well in that, for the most part, I guess, in that show. Whereas here, the chaos that is unleashed by it, I don't know. It seems too much, while also being kind of a repeat of what we had just seen on the TV show.
Yeah, I think that repeat factor is what really bothered me, but more in terms of Elizabeth Olsen's performance, because I liked her in WandaVision, especially the earlier episodes. I think she gives a really fun performance, but then at the end of that show, which for the record I kind of hated,
whole thing, start to finish.
No, just the end. I didn't like how it. Where it went in the end, sure. Just basically as it was subsumed into the Marvel machine and it stopped being about TV, which is what I wanted it to be about.
Yes, yes.
But so once Wanda shifts into that mode and has this all-consuming motivation, she's just evil, what kind of one note, mad woman. And there's it loses a lot of texture to that character and that performance in this movie. And like when considered alongside WandaVision, as a whole, okay, yeah, maybe there's an interesting arc there. But within the context of this movie, it just felt, it became trite, as Scott put it to me, just okay, sad mom, as you put it in the intro.
I think the problem there is, like, I've just finished writing a big piece about this that, like, as we're recording it, it's going up on Polygon tomorrow. By the time people hear this, it will have been up for like 2 weeks and everyone on the internet will have had their chance to yell at me and tell me I'm dumb. But I mean, I walked out of this movie thinking, well, this makes WandaVision a much better story. I like the playfulness of like the early parts of WandaVision, and then it just kind of feels like it breaks down. You know, it loses focus to bring in all of these other Marvel elements. And then in the end, it kind of walks away from the story without telling you who Wanda is, like what she's become, what she feels about everything she's been through besides sad. And it turns out with Multiverse, you find out that the reason all of that was being withheld at the time was because this is a single contiguous story. And they didn't want to give away the fact that, by the way, she's a villain, which, judging from what I've seen online, people definitely did not go into the story knowing that. There was just a big question about who's going to be the bad guy.
Wow.
Really? I thought that was like made very clear by the the post-credit scene of WandaVision.
I don't think so.
It seems like a lot of, I mean, it's funny, like hearing you guys say that you, it, you know, or Tasha saying it enhances that show for her, like, a lot of people I've spoken to have like the opposite, where they feel like they were shocked that she was the villain and it's a betrayal of Wanda and a betrayal of WandaVision and all these sorts of things.
Yeah, those people need to
get back.
And
that's not how I feel. That is how when I've talked to people about it, I have heard that complaint from a number of people.
Those people need to go back and watch the last episode, because I did, and I was surprised many times by stuff that happens at the end, where like I'd remembered some of the big beats, like what she does to Agatha Harkness, which is horrifying. And the sequence where she does it is also horrifying, because Agnes is literally begging her for mercy, like begging her not to do what she's about to do. And she smiles and says, sorry, and does it anyway. Like, she is sadistic to her. And the fact that Agatha Harkness is a manipulative villain, like, doesn't make a difference. If you're a hero, you don't torture people, and you specifically don't torture people because it's convenient or fun for you. So, like, that didn't make a whole lot of sense. The revelation that she had, like, tortured everybody in Westview for days, maybe longer, and she knew that they were literally in pain and she didn't care. Like, that's hard to reconcile with a character that we spend so much time in that show, including in the finale, feeling for her deep, passionate emotions, her sadness and her sense of loss. But when you realize that she walks out of WandaVision basically having decided that other people's emotions don't matter and that she only cares about serving herself, it makes the story make more sense. And it sets up Doctor Strange to, in a way that helps fill in some of the gaps of her being, yes, a very one-note character in this movie. Basically just an implacable force, much more than like a nuanced or interesting person.
I will say, you know, as much as I think the complaints that she is, that her motivations are very simple, are valid. I mean, one thing I liked about her as the villain of this movie was it was a Marvel movie that felt very big and had, you know, and had a lot of stakes and all that sort of thing. But it didn't end in the usual Marvel way of having, you know, a blue laser beam in the sky and an alien invasion and the heroes have to stop the end of the universe. Like, the villain is this woman who wants this one thing and she just is trying to get it the whole movie. And, you know, we don't have some of those formulaic Marvel movie beats in the ending. And I found that, at least, a little refreshing. I think the problem that I had with Wanda being the villain was that, you know, after WandaVision, which I still think is probably the best of all these Marvel Disney Plus shows, it felt very strange to have this movie be not all about Wanda, but have her be so important to it and not have the Vision at least somehow involved.
Like, is he even mentioned?
He's never, I mean, he is mentioned, but only like sort of in glancing moments that don't really involve the story or what Wanda is up to now. And it just felt very, I don't want to say strange, but it felt very strange to have Wanda be so central to the arc of this movie and not have Vision even really addressed or involved. And the more I've thought about that, the more I've realized they sort of put themselves in this weird place where the movie doesn't work with Vision in it, and it doesn't quite fully work with him not in it. Like, when he's not in it here, I'm going, why isn't Vision showing up here? Why isn't somebody mentioning him? Why doesn't somebody go look for the guy? You know, there's that all-white Vision hanging
white
out.
White Vision, yeah.
Yeah, that he's off somewhere, and he seemed like at the end of WandaVision, he at least got some of his memories back. Like, why doesn't Doctor Strange go and recruit him to help them? Why doesn't, you know, why isn't there a Vision in any of those other universes they visit? Like, he's like this weird absence in the movie. And the more I thought about, like, why, and there could be practical reasons, like Paul Bettany was like, I don't feel like doing another one of these, or he
I'm
asked
not
for
under
too much
contract for it.
Right. Or he wanted too much money, but like, on a
or
story
they've already
level,
written the, they've already written the story that he's, maybe, that's going to be right. White Vision.
But on a story level, it's like, if he shows up, I have a hard time imagining the Wanda character being as single-mindedly evil and going all the way through this whole plan that they've engineered for her in this movie. It's hard to imagine all of it working. And so they've sort of engineered this space where there was this huge relationship between these two characters that sort of motivated all of the things that happened prior to Wanda. But then one of those two characters is just not in this movie, and it feels like this huge kind of absence to me. And instead, she's sort of fixated on the children, who, sure, that was a part of WandaVision, but like, the whole point of WandaVision was not about her missing her kids. The kids didn't even exist at that point. Mm-hmm. It was about her being grieving the loss of Vision. And so that, to me, was like, you know, like, there's some interesting aspects of this very long-form Marvel storytelling in Doctor Strange, because you have to sort of follow this character from one movie to the next movie to the TV show back to this movie. And that's kind of interesting if you're really, like, paying attention and you care. It's sort of fun to see this character evolve in this, at least to me, surprising way. But on the flip side, you get into all of these sort of logistical issues where it's like, well, really, Vision should have some kind of a role here. And the fact that he's not, for some reason or another, I think is kind of a problem.
Okay, I got to stick one or into all of that. And that's, it makes perfect sense that it does not occur to Stephen Strange to, like, go fetch up Vision and have him get involved. Because Strange's whole thing, as Christine says repeatedly in kind of the, you know, one of the movie's recurring lines, he's the one that has to hold the knife. Like, he's the one that believes he's the solution to all of the problems. I think it's kind of interesting that even though Wong is now the Sorcerer Supreme, Steven is still the spokesperson. He's still the person that goes to negotiate with Wanda. He's still the person who stands up front whenever anything is going on, while Wong kind of like hangs back in the background.
He still has that cape. I think he should have to give Wong that cape, the cloak thing. Come on, the Sorcerer Supreme should have the flying cloak. I'm sorry.
The cape
but
is
I think
his
it's
friend.
It shows him. It's one of those things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a sentient cape. Like, you don't give away your best friend. And that cape is definitely more of a friend to him than most people. You don't
because
give away your best
talk.
Friend to somebody else. I know, or challenge him, and it does whatever he says. But yeah, going and seeking help from somebody is just not how Doctor Strange works. And a fair bit of this, to the degree that he has an arc in this movie, a fair bit of his arc here, including facing a version of himself who was so determined not to ask for help that he destroyed the world, and hearing about a second one who was executed for exactly that. Like, that's all very much in character. Why White Vision doesn't show up? Like, I'm fine with that. We have no idea what that character is at this point, or like where he is, or what he feels. Why Vision never shows up within the multiverse, and why it doesn't occur to her that she could find another version of him in the same way she could find another version of kids. That's a big hole, and I have no answer for that, and I think you're exactly right.
I hate those kids. Don't you hate the kids? They're terrible. Those little Muppets. Can't stand
oh,
them.
Scott, tell me if your children disappeared, you wouldn't murder
oh,
a
I
teenager
would. I would.
With
They'd
superpowers.
Be worth it, though. They'd be worth it. I would upend the whole damn multiverse for my kids, but not for those kids. Those kids are horrible.
Those kids aren't your kids. People have a tendency to like their kids more than other people's kids.
They're not Wanda's kids. She like...
Yeah, well, exactly.
They're literally her kids. She invented them. She made them up. Like, what else does a mother do?
They're not that Wanda's kids. They're other Wanda's kids.
Well,
wow.
At this point, we're definitely splitting multiversal hairs, and things just completely start to break down. I guess one of my big feelings here is just like a lot of this is just for the spectacle. You know, all the multiverse hopping is for the fun of, hey, here's a, you know, good old Captain Britain, or I don't think that's what they call her here, but, you know, our Captain Carter. Here's good old Captain Carter.
Yes, it's Captain Carter.
down comic book guy. It's fun to see Captain Carter. It's fun to see the alternate version of Captain Marvel. It's fun to have Patrick Stewart show up, not as the previous live action X-Men versions of Professor X, but as the one from the 1990s cartoon, which we know because he's got a big yellow hover chair. And when he shows up, the musical sting from the 90s cartoon plays. And when he uses his powers, there are concentric wavy circles coming out of his forehead. Like, it's straight up a 90s cartoon reference. Stuff like that is just fun. And if you've got to like shovel through a whole lot of nonsense to get to that kind of fun, like, that's definitely a comic book movie decision to make. Is like, we had to bend the rules of time, space, causality, and character, but we got to do this really fun thing.
Here's John Krasinski. He looks like he's in ecstasy, pure cinematic ecstasy over there.
I was like, oh, no, that's delightful, because it's not the Patrick Stewart that I've seen in the other X-Men movies. It is a reference to a cartoon I did not watch, but I like that it's there. And it seems, I don't know. I'm glad that everyone is here knows more about all of this stuff than I do, as usual. But maybe we should take a break here and come back to something I know a little bit more about, which is Army of Darkness, and we can make connections between Doctor Strange and the multiverse in the Multiverse of Madness and Army of Darkness after the break. Now it's time for Connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. You know one thing they have in common? They're directed by Sam Raimi. And Sam Raimi has, well, you know, for sure. And Sam Raimi has, you know, a particular style. And I think that you don't have to squint that often, or occasionally don't have to squint at all to find that style present in Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, which is unlike virtually every other film in the MCU, which I think is a little bit harder to connect director with movie. I think you can make, you know, I mean, you could make a case for Joe Johnston and the first Captain America. Maybe you could talk about Taika Waititi and what he brings to his Thor movie, and I guess his upcoming Thor movie as well. But there is, you know, a point in Multiverse of Madness that is in Raimi's wheelhouse, and I think we've identified that point as being towards the second half. Though, you know, the sequence where they're tumbling through, where America and Strange are tumbling through various universes, is, I think, a wonderful kind of Raimi-esque sequence. But then once you get to into the dark hold, and you get, and really the intensity level picks up in Doctor Strange. I mean, there's been a little bit of controversy here and there about how intense this film gets and how much it kind of edges into horror in a way that the other MCU films don't. And I think that's kind of the strength of the film, is when it kind of unleashes a little bit, when it has an opportunity to loosen up and just give you a lot of gags and a lot of kind of darker visual effects, and that's kind of where it feels a little bit like almost a de facto sequel to like a fourth, you know, Evil Dead movie. I think that's kind of where this Doctor Strange is at its best. What do you all think?
I just wanted to share a little anecdote inspired by Tasha talking about how she saw this at like a packed screening with her coworkers and, you know, a bunch of comics nerds, and, you know, her freaking out about the little Easter eggs and cameos and whatnot. I saw this at a critic screening here in Michigan which had a grand total of 5 people in it, two of whom I believe were guests. It was not a deep film critic community where I live. Giant house too, which it was actually quite funny. But like the only audible reactions I heard in the theater were in these very Raimi-y moments. Bruce Campbell cameo was that brought the house down, like the four people.
All five people.
Yeah. All seated very far away from each other. I should know, but it could the fact that I could even hear an audible response, is telling. And then like, you know, when it was over and we're watching the credits and waiting for the inevitable 1 to 3 credit sequences, you know, all of the like snippets of conversation I heard, it was all just talking about Raimi. You know, like that was, I think like to anyone who has an affinity or even just a baseline knowledge of him, I would put myself more in the latter category. You know, I'm not like a super fan by any means, but like, I think seeing the director in a movie like this is really exciting, as Scott notes, you know, and maybe at this point in the MCU to a certain type of fan, more exciting than, you know, the Black Bolt making his return to this. Was Inhumans technically part of this MCU? That like very brief.
Who knows?
I don't even know.
Knows?
But I don't know.
Maybe.
But good for Anson Mount. Is that
Mount? Anson Mount.
Yeah. Mount. Yeah. Yeah. Good for him. But yeah. So it is kind of exceptional in these films, you know.
I mean, I know personally, I was like kind of as the movie is going on and it is getting more sort of overtly Raimi-ish, I'm like leaning forward in my chair because it's like all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute, oh, there's a POV shot going through Wanda's house, and the POV is kind of messing, it's like stopping and starting and messing around with those kids. That's a little Raimi there. And I, because you know, this is the first movie he's directed in I think 9 years. He doesn't do a lot of stuff. And so, like, these movies are to be treasured when he finally makes something. And you would hate for him to waste it on something that isn't going to feel like one of his movies, which, given how Marvel stuff tends to feel, you know, so similar. And I say that as someone who likes a lot of them. Like, I was legitimately kind of concerned we were going to get, like, a faceless Sam Raimi movie, which, like, who wants that? But, you know, the longer it goes, I feel like the more and more it does kind of get, it gets darker and Raimi-er. I can't find the right adjective to describe this. You know, there isn't like a, you know, Kubrickian or a Coen's-esque here. It's like, I keep making things
Raimi-ish
up.
Raimi-ish would work
Raimi-ish
just fine.
Raimi-ish is the right
Raimi-ish.
One.
Raimi-ish. I mean, you just gotta like look at the vowel at the end and see what tacks on there.
But you know, when like Wanda is climbing out of a mirror, and, you know, and I really think that ending, which I already mentioned, is, you know, the idea of a zombie superhero who's covered in ghouls, giving a heartfelt speech to a earnest young superhero about, like, the value of believing in yourself. That is almost like an image and an idea that is so singular in terms of like all of the things that Raimi loves in one moment. Like it is almost like one of the most Raimi-ish, Raimi-esque, whatever, moments of his entire career. Like it's silly, it's scary, it's funny, it's sincere, you know, it has this heartfelt belief in like the value of heroes, but it's being delivered by this ridiculous looking monster with half his teeth out of his face exposed. It is really pure Sam Raimi in that moment. And it's coming in this big Marvel machine movie. And so to me, like that was like the single best and most exciting moment, because I was like, no one else could have done that in a, you know, you didn't need to know that Sam Raimi worked on this movie. Like you could have, if you didn't have his name in the beginning, you would have recognized that. Or I feel like I would have, like so many of those other Marvel movies, it's like you wouldn't know who directed them. Even when they tell you, you're like, who is that? And what
Branagh,
else have they done?
Kenneth Branagh to... It's like, I recognize that camera move from Peter's Friends.
The cinema du Alan Taylor. It's like, you know, whatever. And that moment really, it feels to me at least like something that could only have come in a Sam Raimi movie. And I love that about it.
That's amazing, Matt. I hate that scene. I hate it so much.
No.
I despise it. I really hate hero stories where it turns out that you just needed to try harder. Like the thing that you can't do that's impossible to do, you just need to look within yourself and see why you haven't done that and then do it instead. You know, so this uncontrollable power that she's never had any control over before, Zombie Doctor Strange is like, no, it was within you all along. Like you're already wearing the damn shoes. Just click them together. Like it wasn't the magic feather which you dropped a while ago. Come
on, Oz, the great and powerful.
These are bad examples because, well, here's the thing. These are bad examples because I like Wizard of Oz and Dumbo, but they're also good examples because those movies are great and they're also ancient. Like this is how long we've been doing that in cinema, and having somebody just say, yeah, that power that you can't control, you can totally control it. Just control it. And then she's like, oh, well, why did I never try that before? Ding, everything's solved. It's like, I don't know. I always go back to Buffy the Vampire Slayer and like fighting the super duper extra heavy powered vamps that are the worst thing ever. And she's defeated and she's defeated and she's defeated. And then eventually she realizes the problem was she needed to hit them harder. You know, like... There's something to be said in stories, in hero stories, for like determination and focus and will and need saving the day. Like that is a very satisfying beat. But hey, this thing that you've never tried before, just do it and it'll work out perfectly. Like that always makes me roll my eyes, and it makes me roll my eyes here. Even when it is coming from like a half-faced Doctor Strange corpse that he's puppeting around from another dimension while CGI ghouls hang off of him, which all of that is very hilarious. And definitely the most Sam Raimi, like tormenting Bruce Campbell part of it all.
Well, and that's the thing is Raimi didn't write this movie, you know, like when Matt's talking about that scene, he's talking about like the visual of it, the visceralness of it, I guess, like the comedy of it, you know, the horror of it, not the actual speech and how it fits into the story of the movie. Like I'm sure Raimi had, you know, some say and some input in terms of the narrative of this film, but talking about this connection, I think it's really about the style less than the script, which not that I think Raimi, based on Army of Darkness, would have, and I guess Spider-Man 3 would have been a better choice here. But I do really want to quick, before we leave this, like bring the Spider-Man of it all into this, because are we in agreement that like this feels more Raimi-ish than his Spider-Man films?
No, those were also Raimi-ish.
But do they have the horror element to the extent that this does?
No,
it's in fits and starts. I mean, Spider-Man 2 has that amazing Doc Ock sequence where the arms come alive in the operating room. And number 3 has some stuff with Venom. And there's, you know, and there's some sort of like body horror to the first movie when he's getting his powers. And there's kind of nightmarish sequences a little bit. But it's less horror. It's less overtly horror-ish than this movie.
There's a kineticism, though, that his films share. I mean, so you could also talk about, you know, The Quick and the Dead, for example. I mean, that's not really a horror. There's nothing really a horror about that. It's his take on a Western, but his take on a Western is that it's going to have a tremendously active camera and a lot of humor, a lot of irreverence. And I think that is something that primarily translates here. And as far as like this specific film Multiverse of Madness, I think it just story-wise it syncs up really well with Army of Darkness, which is why we ended up choosing it over Darkman, which was my original choice for this pairing. Was really more based on Doctor Strange and kind of trying to contrast those two as characters, and just you know, Raimi as somebody who at that time was making an original superhero movie. I thought it was a kind of a nice point of contrast to Doctor Strange, but after seeing Multiverse of Madness, it just had so many strong Evil Dead vibes, particularly Army of Darkness, that couldn't resist. I had to make the change.
I mean, it's all about the evil book.
Yeah, in the evil book, right? It's like, oh, that's good. And
a zombie version of the hero, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know,
dead things yanking on his face and making it change shape and size in really goofy ways.
One thing I wanted to get into too is something that Matt had brought up in the first segment on Army of Darkness, and that's the effects. Because with Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, I mean, that's all DIY style effects that really feels handmade. And I think a lot of those qualities carry over to Army of Darkness too, when the effects work there, which I think Matt made a really good argument, are extremely well crafted. The effects in Multiverse of Madness, those are MCU effects. And in the way, and I guess the process for doing that is different. The feeling of it is different. I don't think it's crazy for me to say that it does not quite have that handcrafted feel, that it feels like that element of it is a little bit more given over to a unit, a different power, you know, and that affects the film in a pretty profound way. Am I wrong on that, or did you see some raminess in the actual effects work here?
I think there's a pretty straight line between Ash getting his face sucked into the book and coming out like Beetlejuice, like with it completely distorted and changing shape, and Doctor Strange getting sucked through the multiverse and having his head come apart in like CGI squares. I think that's the exact same mentality. Okay. It's just coming from like very different budgets and very different, you know, technologies, essentially. But in terms of, here's a dead rotting guy that's being played by the hero, and he's got like dead things yanking on him, like in both movies. I think that it's the exact same thing in both of these films. It's just in one of them, he's got a budget and it's got to look like a Marvel movie. And in another one, he doesn't. And he wants it to look like a Harryhausen movie. But I think it's the same mentality. I think it's still very, very connected.
But why? 30 years later, and with, you know, God knows how many more times the budget, does it look so much worse than Army of Darkness?
To me, like, where I find, I don't know the answer to that question, but to me, where I see the Raimi visually, especially in this movie, is in the use of the camera, specifically the moving camera. You know, the shots where Strange wakes up in his bed and the camera does like a full 360 as he's waking up and leaping forward. Or when, you know, there's shots where people are kind of like sitting up and the camera tilts with them. Like, the camera is not as nimble as in, you know, Army of Darkness. I don't think they ever strapped a camera to a 2x4 and ran it through a green screen, perhaps to the movie's detriment. But you do occasionally feel that playfulness and that sort of visceral moving camera, which just, you know, in a movie like Army of Darkness, I think just adds so much tactility, and you just feel like just everything about it just feels more alive. The way that the camera is just constantly in motion in that movie, the snap zooms, the way when someone points at someone, the camera zooms in on their hand, so the hand is gigantic. Like, it's just, you know, there is a playfulness to that maybe, you know, maybe that's less present in Doctor Strange, especially in the action scenes, just because you can't like improvise, maybe. And maybe that's the thing that's missing somewhat, is that, you know, the Evil Dead ethos is like, yeah, let's stick a camera on a bicycle and see what happens. Let's stick it on a 2x4 and run it around and see what happens. You can't really leave those kind of things to chance with these kind of movies. They're all storyboarded and made so meticulously that any sort of camera movement has to be planned so carefully in advance, and probably makes things even more difficult for the visual effects artist. So you have to do those things maybe more sparingly or more calculatedly, and it loses something in that translation to a big budget movie versus something more run and gun and small. But, you know, I think Tasha mentioned some visuals that are very reminiscent of Army of Darkness and other Raimi movies. And I did, again, in some of the moments where, you know, like that POV camera in Wanda's house and, you know, or other Wanda's house, where the camera is kind of creeping around, it's getting that old deadite magic. It's got me in its spell again, just a little. It's not long. You don't get a ton of it, but like, it's not a full-fledged, you know, steady cam minute-long take, but you get little hints of it here or there, which, again, compared to some of the other Marvel movies and how similar and same they all feel, I very much welcomed those flashes.
I also reject your semi-rhetorical question as inherently biased, Scott. Like,
what's that?
Why does everything in Army of Darkness look so much better than everything in Multiverse of Madness? Like, I think the plunge through different universes where they're turning into paint and
that's neat. That's like shot wise, my favorite in the movie. That's neat.
I also think it's while I don't think it makes a damn lick of sense, when the souls of the damned, whatever the hell that means in Marvel, apparently there's a heaven and hell in Marvel, which implies a god and a devil and an afterlife and just a whole bunch of other nonsense. Whatever. The army of the dead comes after Doctor Strange because he broke a rule that was definitely a rule about crossing dimensions in order to possess your own body. Very bad stuff. But the point is, he ends up turning them into a cloak of angry dead people and using them to fly around. I think that looks cooler than like Bruce Campbell lying on his face in a soundstage while people poke him with skeleton sticks.
No, we're not doing this. No. But wow. I mean, what about stuff like the
your Luddite is showing, Scott.
No, but it's great. I mean, that stuff is it's unimpeachable. But
I impeach. I'm moved to impeach.
You're not yawning your way through, say, Scarlet Witch attacking the big sequence where she's attacking the Wong and his, you know, in the fortress, right? Like, that doesn't bore you to death.
I didn't yawn my way through that, but it was primarily because there's that moment in the middle of all of that where she's throwing glowing CGI frap at them and they're shooting CGI weapons at her and blah, blah, blah. And then she just decides that the solution to this is to get into somebody's head and manipulate it. And she slides out from behind somebody in a really creepy shot that could be done practically. And I kind of don't think it was, because it looks very digital. But like, that to me, she does that again later when she meets up with Professor X and tells him what she thinks about what he's been up to. And I think it's effective both times. And I think it's a very Raimi touch. This moment of somebody appearing out of nowhere in a very eerie way. And like, there are just like little ghoulish, scary, once again, sadistic touches throughout Multiverse of Madness that feel very auteurish. And to me, the dealing with Wanda's mind control specifically in that visual way is both very Raimi-ish and just makes it a lot more interesting than what kind of becomes the standard superhero movie, one CGI thing bashes against another CGI thing a whole lot that we get so often.
All right, how about the opening sequence? That's bad too. That's bad. The dream sequence, it's not a dream. That looks terrible, right?
As far as Raimi's concerned, I thought it looked
pretty crummy. I was a little nervous.
It was almost like Raimi might as well be in Cancun when that thing is shot. Like, what does he even do? What role does he even have to play when they're doing stuff like that? I don't know. But that's I'm grinding an axe here. This was something that Genevieve had brought up, because we are dealing with sequels here. Army of Darkness is a second sequel. This is a sequel that is connected to a bunch of other stuff. what has changed? What about the sequelness of these movies?
Well, also to connect it to the Raimi-ness of it, one is Raimi doing a sequel to his own films and one is him not.
No, right, but, sure.
And I was just thinking of in the first part of this conversation when we talked about how Army of Darkness just like gives you like a 3-minute recap of everything you need to know, which is not very much. It shows you scenes from the movie. Wherein like contrasting it with this, like if you haven't seen WandaVision, like you're kind of SOL here, you know, or yeah. You know, and like this is what Marvel does. This is like the great, I don't want to say trick they've pulled, but you know, what they've managed to pull off is kind of incredible in terms of making fans need to see, to consume all these other pieces of Marvel to get like the full experience, you know, and a contrast with Army of Darkness, which like I think we kind of agreed that it does stand on its own, you know, even if you haven't seen the previous two Evil Deads.
Yeah, but only because it includes a montage boiling down, hey, here's everything important that happened. Like,
but it needs
If Multiverse of Madness started with, here's what you missed on WandaVision, like, you'd have a better footing in the movie.
I mean, honestly, I would have loved it if Multiverse of Madness started with a, like, WandaVision-style, TV-style, like, previously on as sort of, like, a connective tissue there. But it's all, like, outside of the film, you know?
As a movie person, do I like having to have watched a television program in order to understand what is happening in a movie? I do not. I do not like that. That is not a good development for me.
As we discussed, like, last week, like, I had zero problems having Army of Darkness be my first Evil Dead movie. And, you know, yeah, it has 3 minutes of catching you back up. But, you know, it's like, it's almost irrelevant. It's just sort of setting the table, I guess. Forget about, like, imagine not having seen WandaVision. Like, imagine not having seen some of the previous movies. There's, like, 28 or whatever now. It's just, like, it's, like, inconceivable that someone could just walk in cold to this movie and kind of, like, get it. It's, I almost would be fascinated to do that as, like, an experiment. Like, just pluck someone who's never seen a Marvel movie and just be like, okay, watch this and make sense of it and try to explain to me afterwards, like, what is going on and what they would think of it. It definitely is a different strategy, certainly, of, like, you know, right down to the fact that it's not called Evil Dead 3, it's Army of Darkness, you know, like, it doesn't necessarily signify outwardly. You have to really know that it's an Evil Dead movie in a way, like... you know, like I think I said on the previous episode, like, I'm not even sure I knew about that it was an Evil Dead movie fully until afterwards. Whereas here it's Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. And you really need to know a lot of stuff to follow this movie, or to at least to really, like, get it. You know, like, WandaVision especially, you know, like, that's pretty important, I would say, to the overall film and enjoying it and processing it. So, and, you know, like we were saying, like, that's the point. Like, that's Marvel's whole model, is that it's not, you have to see everything. You've got to follow everything. You've got to stay, you know, up on this stuff, because it all matters. And if you don't watch this show or that movie, well... When they all cross over in the next movie or the next show, you're gonna be out of luck.
Come to trying to put my finger on why it is that I enjoy that with Marvel, and it irks me when Star Wars does it. Like, Star Wars has gone to the same sort of place where, like, hey, in this movie, C-3PO shows up and he's got a red arm. We're not going to explain that. We are going to make a big point of it. Like, the character's going to talk about it, but we're not going to explain why it's important. And in fact, it isn't important. And it turns out that in order to understand that, you have to have read the tie-in comic that they put together for it, explaining why he has a red arm, which doesn't make a damn bit of difference. When General Grievous first shows up in the live-action movies, he's given pretty much no introduction, and you're supposed to understand why a robot has asthma and like four lightsabers and a serious attitude problem. And it's because, you know, they had set him up elsewhere. So, like, that kind of thing annoys me with Star Wars. Oh, the same thing with Saw Gerrera. Like, he's just not a character in the movie where he shows up, Rogue One, because he was set up elsewhere. And finding him at the end of his arc and as a guy who's just like, hi, I'm here. I'm tired and angry and jaded from the battles you know nothing of and that we will not speak of. I have reached the end of my line, and here's gonna be my dramatic death. And you're like, who are you? And I have to believe that my experience as a pretty much movies only Star Wars person, at least up until the Disney Plus series, is what somebody who tries to be a casual Marvel viewer would feel like. I don't even, like, even if you had seen WandaVision and had seen Avengers Infinity War and had the setup for, you know, all of Wanda's grief and going bad, and had seen Doctor Strange 1 and understood, like, why he's worked up about Christine and who Wong is and what all this stuff is going on. If you don't really know much about comics, I just don't know how you process oh my God, here's the Illuminati. Like, here are all of these characters drawn from other things. It was just so clear that my theater was engaged and excited and thought all of that was amazing. Like, the house came down when Black Bolt showed up. But if none of these people mean anything to you, what does it mean when it's just like, hey, here's a bunch of people. We're not going to spend any time with them, and they're all going to be messily dead soon. Like, all of these movies are meant for people who love these movies specifically more and more and more.
I agree completely with what you just said.
Genevieve, can you cut that and strike a print of it that I can just like play back whenever I want? I just want a soundboard of Scott agrees with Tasha.
We already have a soundboard for the Scott Tobias noise of disgust. So maybe we can build it out.
Always my favorite.
Sometimes I just like to imagine going back in time and visiting myself as a 14-year-old who went to extreme, almost like espionage lengths to hide the fact that I read comic books from everyone in my life, to tell that person, you know, they're not only going to make movies out of these things. Someday, Black Bolt is going to come on the screen and the entire audience is going to cheer. I just would love to know what I would have thought at that age. You know, I would have thought that I was lying to myself, certainly. I would have not believed. I would have thought it was some sort of Raimi-esque Book of the Dead trick on me, I'm sure. I would not have bought it.
So let's try to wrap this up by kind of going back to the beginning and where things started, which is Bruce Campbell. Bruce Campbell is the lead in Army of Darkness, and he has a cameo in this film in Multiverse of Madness, and how does that all kind of tie together for you, and what sort of feelings did that, I guess, evoke seeing Campbell in this movie?
I gotta say, I did not recognize him when he showed up for the first cameo, and I thought the whole thing seemed weirdly out of place. I was just like,
oh no,
you know, Doctor Strange is kind of a jerk, but cursing this guy to hit himself continuously for 3 weeks and like shrugging off the fact like you would die if you were hitting yourself, if you were knocking yourself down every 3 seconds, you would die. And he's just so flippant about it. He's so like, it might wear off, whatever. It makes so much more sense when you think about it in terms of Matt's feeling that the entire world just lives to punish Bruce Campbell. Like, Doctor Strange being more flippant about hurting people than usual, him not caring if Bruce Campbell beats himself up, makes so much more sense within the parameters of the Bruce Campbell is the world's butt monkey theory. I didn't get the joke until the button on the end of the movie when he comes back. And then I was just like, how the hell did I miss that? I was very disappointed in myself. I've seen a few people online suggest that Bruce Campbell cameo should replace Stan Lee cameo now that Stan Lee is no longer with us. I'd be kind of on board for that. You know, Bruce Campbell shows up and gets hurt in some ridiculous slapstick way in every movie. I'd do that.
Does he have to play the Pizza Papa, or is he playing other parts? Should the Pizza Papa become the new Stan Lee?
different universe, okay. different character every single time.
Okay.
Wow. We're
poked in the eye by something different every single time.
So you were...
I was imagining like, is this, you know, is the Pizza Papa this universe's version of Ash, you know, not because I am a dork, but I wasn't like, oh, I wonder. It was more like, because I always love the fact about Army of Darkness that, you know, that ending, which we didn't talk about that much, but, you know, that he winds up back in the present. But basically, like, he leaves this essentially being the king and the coolest guy in the past to go be a stock boy at a box chain store. Like, that's the choice he makes. Again, speaking to the stupidity of Ash.
If you take him at his word on that, which I really don't think you're supposed to, like,
right.
he's a dumb blowhard. Like, his insistence that he was going to be the king doesn't really jibe with a medieval land that doesn't even seem to have a king. Like, even Arthur isn't King Arthur. He's Lord Arthur.
Well, at least he could have stayed with Sheila instead of going back to be a lonely stock boy.
What, with the she-bitch? I mean, I don't know why he would have wanted to stay with her. He he never seemed to like her. Even when he was kissing her, he didn't seem to like her much.
Give me some sugar, baby. That didn't, I don't know.
It's a fun line, and it's certainly a very quoted line, but it doesn't speak to any kind of like deep emotional connection that would make him want to give up the 20th century connection. And like,
I don't know.
You know,
I just
gasoline for his chainsaw hand.
I just get a kick out of him like being like, well, gotta go back to my exciting life as a stock boy.
Okay, he loves S-Mart.
And so I just think that you could see that guy winding up being a guy selling pizza on the street also. Like, that doesn't seem that far-fetched to me.
But do you...
I mean, that guy also used to be the king of another dimension, and he came back to that earth in order to be a pizza guy.
To sell pizzas, yeah.
Yep.
But would
shop
you
smart.
Be a,
shop pizza mart.
Would you rather be a king...
Shop pizza cart.
And, you know, a king in the miserable...
Congratulations. Well done.
Would you rather be king in the miserable realm of, you know, 1300s, or... Would you rather be, you know, a pauper in the land of, you know, where the Mexican pizza's coming back to Taco Bell? I mean, that sounds to me like a better fate. I would rather have the humbler job.
These are the serious, weighty themes of Army of Darkness. This is what we were looking for. We finally found it.
We finally cracked the Raimi code. And with that, Army of Darkness is streaming on HBO Max. It's rentable on the usual services. It's available on Blu-ray and DVD. Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness is in theaters now. That's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show, but we'll be back next week with a new pairing. Tasha, want to set us up for our episodes releasing on May 31st and June 7th?
Okay, so if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably a fairly serious fan of cinema. And when I tell you that half of our next pairing is going to be the Disney Plus movie Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers, you're probably going to have questions. But hear me out on this one. The movie is a live-action meta story that takes place in an LA where animated characters rub shoulders with humans, and cartoons are just live-action movies with toon characters against painted sets. There's a conspiracy aimed at the toon inhabitants of L.A., and Chip and Dale, former TV partners who've fallen out, are the toon characters who need to go outside the system to solve it, with the help of a disgraced human cop. Oh, and it's absolutely stuffed with familiar and obscure animated characters just casually walking around to give the world some shape. The director, Lonely Island's Akiva Schaffer, who also directed our beloved music industry spoof Popstar, Never Stop, Never Stopping, and the writers, Dan Greger and Doug Mand of How I Met Your Mother, are clearly following the footsteps of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and they acknowledge it, to the point where Roger himself is one of the many characters who shows up for a cameo, which suggests this story takes place in the same world many decades later. Talking about Chip and Dale, Rescue Rangers, and Who Framed Roger Rabbit together seemed like a no-brainer. So that's exactly what we're doing next time on The Next Picture Show.
For now, we welcome your feedback on Army of Darkness, Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net and come talk to us at Patreon, where you'll find feedback, letters, and discussion. Before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days, Tasha Robinson?
I am the film and streaming editor at Polygon.com. You can find me writing a fair bit about WandaVision and Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, including talking to the screenwriter about the big question of whether Wanda Maximoff is dead. You can find me on Twitter at Tosh Robinson. Genevieve?
I am the TV editor at Vulture.com, and you can find me on various social media channels at Genevieve Kosky. Matt Singer, where are you these days? Where can people find your work?
Oh, I'm working over at Screen Crush, screencrush.com, and my Twitter account is at Matt Singer.
No, wait. You don't want to plug your book about superheroes on the podcast about superheroes?
I mean, it's not about Doctor Strange.
In another universe it is, but...
Okay. Well, if people want to read my Spider-Man book, it is available, yes. And other than that one lady who didn't like that how it was shipped, it has remarkable reviews on Amazon. And it's called Marvel's Spider-Man, From Amazing to Spectacular, The Definitive Comic Art Collection. And I did not come up with that title. Scott!
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias. You can find my work in the New York Times, in Guardian, in Vulture, The Ringer, and other fine publications, and a great deal of my work these days is for the newsletter that I compose with our absent co-host Keith Phipps. That's The Reveal, thereveal.substack.com. As for Keith Phipps, you can find him on Twitter at kphipps3000, and his work also appears in The Ringer, GQ, Entertainment Weekly, and other such publications. Stay updated on the Next Picture Show at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod. Get bonus content and open discussion at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And as always, we appreciate your rating and reviews on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. Thanks to Dan the Baked Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.